is class number 5, titled Samson's Fatal Brinkmanship. The introductory reading was Judges chapter 16, verses 1 through 21. I'll give it over to Brother Jim.
You flog the chairman as well in this place. He gets the 4 sessions on Saturday. Mark's held up under the pressure, but I'm actually getting a cold, so I rang Auntie Margaret this afternoon just to see how she was going. And it was Sunday morning in Brisbane, being something like a 15 or 16 hour time difference. And she said their Saturday had been 41 degrees centigrade, which is, I don't know, 104, 105 Fahrenheit or something like that. So they were roasting. Well, I said, I am freezing. And I think the contrast, because it was less than a week ago that I was coming out of temperatures like that, I think the contrast might have got to me. So I'm going to love you and leave you tonight. When I'm done on this session, I'm going to go and take some potions and spray a few things up my nose and, you know, get some sleep, do the things you need to do so I can talk tomorrow. I know, I said to Paul, Brother Paul Stiles, I said, I've got a sore throat. You know, he says, oh, you talk too much. Well, I don't know about him, but we'll do our best, young people. The voice is okay at the moment. And it works, mate. Well, we come to what really is a very sad story, young people, in Judges 16. You know, it has a sad ending as well. But it's got a positive ending, this story, and we're going to look at that tomorrow morning, God willing, and we're going to see that though Samson dies along with thousands of Philistines, and he's under the rubble with them, he does at least die a Nazarite. He has got his act together by that point. He is back in harmony with his God. He has pleaded for help. And the very fact that God answers him shows that that man has been forgiven. And that when the resurrection comes, he will be raised to live forever along with the faithful. We know that because, of course, his name is recorded elsewhere. It's in that great list of the faithful. And so, brothers and sisters and young people, what I want to try and say tonight and tomorrow is this, that while it's necessary for us to highlight the failures of Samson, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that, there is no reason, whatever state of mind we might be in, wherever we might get ourselves by stupidity and folly, there is no reason that we cannot be recovered. If we turn back to our God, he will and he can work with us to bring us out of the mire of our own making. That's the story of Samson. So it does have an encouraging and positive conclusion, though it is an extremely sad story. We're going to watch this man spiral down. I'm going to talk about that spiral. Because at some point in life, whether it happens when you're young or a little older, at some point in life, we're all going to go through a similar experience to Samson. We're going to get in that spiral, you know, like a whirlpool. And you just keep going down, and of course, eventually you hit bottom. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. But this man is going to be there for an example for all of us as to what can be done. And the record is pretty specific about what can be done. So, in this final chapter on the life of Samson, there are 3 brackets of Eshtaol and Zorah. So in chapter 16 verse 1 we have the voice inside Samson telling him to go down to Gaza and to cohabit with a harlot woman. But in verse 3 he takes the gates of Gaza towards Hebron, if not to Hebron, in an act of unbelievable strength. You know why? Well, he's had a change of mind. That's why. He had a change of mind. And Yahweh immediately helps him. So whereas the voice that's appealing to him to fulfill his desires has overtaken him for a brief moment, the Spirit is able to strike down. And that is an experience that all of us will go through in our life. Then we have, of course, the second bracket. We're going to see the activity of Delilah. Her voice appealing for him to reveal his secret. And then, of course, we're going to see the way in which not Samson striking down Philistines, but Samson being struck down by Philistines. That's the tragedy. And then finally, tomorrow morning, God willing, we're going to see his plaintive appeal to his God for help in a desperate situation. And we're going to see a final striking down of the flesh. And Zora will prevail in the life of Samson. That's the wonderful positive end to the story amidst the misery. And that's what this chapter's about. The misery of a man who's bound up in his own weaknesses. Well, the record says in chapter 16, verse 1, then went Samson to Gaza. It's not an inconsiderable distance from where he was at Zora to travel right down to Gaza. Why would he go all that way? Well, he went there for a reason. It says, then went Samson to Gaza and saw there a harlot and went in unto her. He was going on a journey which he knew would ultimately lead to this, because he was now embraced once more by the weakness of his eyes. He saw there a harlot. He knew he would. I mean, if you go wandering around the wrong sorts of districts, you're going to find people like this, aren't you? So it's a fact of life. You go in the wrong place, well, you'll meet the wrong kind of people. It's as simple as that. And that's what happened. And so his weakness overtakes him again. And he goes in. Now, Gaza means the strong. Sadly, of course, he wasn't showing too much spiritual strength. It was the stronghold and monument of Philistine power. And it becomes the place to display Samson's weakness. He saw there an harlot. Now, in the Hebrew, there are two words, Ishar, Zanar. Literally, a woman, a harlot. His eyes, his desires overcome him again. And he went in unto her. So there's a declension from chapter 14, verse 1. Just come back to 14, verse 1. This is exactly the same thing that's happening in his life that happened when he was a younger man. Judges 14, verse 1. And Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. But what he did was that he came up and presented the matter to his father and mother. Now, this is how sin works, young people. You get yourself into trouble, it's much easier to do it again. Repeat offences are much simpler. And the more often you do the same thing, the easier it is to do it, and the less your conscience will kick in. That's how it works. So you need to do some early treatment of the problem, to recognise it for what it is up front and say, no, I know where that leads, and I am not going down that path. If you've been down that path before, you'll have good reasons not to go down that path. If it's early days for you, then you can take the counsel that we received from the story of Samson. We can just look at the experience of others. And it's not a pretty picture. You keep going down that path, you end up with a conscience seared with a hot iron, and the conscience simply doesn't work anymore. And I have seen people get to that state, and it's a horrible place to be. Because when you get to that point, you feel as though you are completely cut off from your God. You can recover, but you feel as though you're completely cut off from your God. And I don't know any greater torture than that. It's a terrible place to be. So you see, what's happening here is in chapter 14, verse 1, this is the first mistake, but it leads to others, which are much easier steps to take. And this man is there to demonstrate how the flesh works and what God really wants us to do when we get into these sorts of situations. Now, the record says in chapter 16, verse 2, that it was told the Gazites, saying, Samson is come hither. And they compassed him in and laid wait for him all night in the gate of the city, and were quiet all the night, saying, in the morning, when it is day, we shall kill him. So they were quiet all night. Rotherham says, but they kept themselves quiet all night, which is difficult for Philistines. And we made the point in John 3 and verse 19 that men love darkness. That's the lesson that Christ gave to Nicodemus. Men love darkness. They creep around in the darkness. That's when they're usually active. Well, the Philistines, they made a mess of this. They were quiet. And they should have taken him at the moment of his greatest weakness, but they didn't. They say, in the morning. Now, this in fact is really the meaning of Samson's name, isn't it? His name means brilliant sunlight. That's what you see in the morning. Awake unto the light of the morning. Big mistake. Verse 3 says, and Samson lay till midnight, and arose at midnight. You know, it's nearly midnight now. No, I don't mean, you know, 12 o'clock on Saturday the 4th of January. I mean it's nearly midnight in terms of the purpose of God. Christ is about to appear. You know what he said? Son of Man comes. Well, there he comes at midnight. You've got to be ready. Well, young people, you know the signs. Many of you do know the signs. And you know that it's nearly midnight. Christ is about to come. It's about that time when if we're going to make some changes to our life, we need to do it. We need to do it. Now, nearly midnight. And this is what happens in Samson's experience here. Now, we don't know what it was at midnight. Who knows? By this time, he may have taken his fill and he's having second thoughts. He's got some misgivings as to why he's here in this place. What am I doing here? You ever ask yourself that question? What am I doing here? You're an idiot. What are you doing here? Well, when that sort of question is asked, that's your conscience working. You know what you've got to do? Say, you're an idiot. You are a fool. Get out of here. Now, that's what's happening to this man. And it happens at midnight. Get out of here. And so he gets up. Do you notice these words? This word midnight in the Hebrew, in fact, there's two Hebrew words. Chetzi Layil. Literally, this phrase should read, it was the middle of the twist away from light. Interesting phrase, isn't it? The middle of the twist away from light. So this man, Samson, has been twisting away from the light. He should be walking in the light, but he's bent, twisted, away from the light. In the middle of his experience, he wakes up to himself and says, I've got to do something here. And immediately you do that, young people, God can work. Immediately you acknowledge your folly and stupidity, that you're in the wrong place. God can work. But if you insist on staying there, which he does in the next story, when he's with Delilah, you insist on staying there, then it's not a great deal God can do for you. But as soon as you make up your mind that that's enough, you want out, God will be there to help in some way. So what happens here? He arose at midnight, and he took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and went away with them. Imagine the Philistines who were sort of dozing, waiting for the morning, when this man, who looked like any other man, he didn't appear to have any greater strength than any other man, comes along, and the gates of the city are huge, and just pulls them off their hinges and walks away with them. I mean, they would have been completely and utterly shocked by that. Well, what's this about? Well, what is the gates of the city really about? Well, of course, you know, don't you, that the gates of ancient cities was the most important place in the city. Genesis 22 verse 17, it says of Christ that he will possess the gate of his enemies. And you can go right through the scripture and find that the gate was used for many things. It was the place of judging, of ownership, control, the place of the markets, and a whole range of things happened at the gates of the city. The two posts. So, of course, you're going to hang gates on posts, you have to have a post on either side. That's the stability of the city. That's the stronghold in which men can take refuge. Well, he doesn't just take the gates, he takes the posts on which the gates are hung. Incredible what happens here. Now, here are some references to the gates of the city. There's the quotation from Genesis 22 and verse 17, the gate of his enemies. But we have, of course, other passages. There's Deuteronomy 12, verse 12, which says that the gates actually represented the whole city. Take the gates, you got the law. It was here that the people resorted to hear news in the days of Nehemiah, when Ezra read from a platform in that wonderful chapter, Nehemiah 8. It was here that the judges administered justice in Israel, Joshua 20, verse 4. It was here that you had great dignitaries that came from other places, sitting in the gate. And it was here that you held a market, as it happens, of course, in 2 Kings 7, verse 1, when the Lord upon whom the king leaned was trampled to death. Remember that story? So the gate was a very important place in Israel. Now, these gates were picked up by Samson and carried towards Hebron. Now, we can't be absolutely sure that he went all the way to Hebron. He may have done so. The record says that he went away with them, bar and all, and put them upon his shoulders. And he carried them up to the top of a hill that is before Hebron. So he tears them off, bar and all. And that means, of course, the bar that crossed the two gates, they locked them against entry or exit. And, of course, we have that as the work of Christ in the future, in Micah chapter 2, verses 12 to 13, which speak of the recovery of scattered Israel and the work of Christ through Elijah to bring Israel back to the land. We have the expression, the breaker, Christ, is come up before them. They have broken up and have passed through the gate and are gone out by it, and their king shall pass before them. It's actually talking about the recovery of Israel from their captivity. And Christ, of course, will perform that work. He's described here as the breaker. He's going to break apart the gates and carry them off, so to speak. That's exactly what Samson does here. It's only possible, of course, through the power of the Spirit. It says he puts them on his shoulders. Now, the shoulder is a symbol for rulership and for government in the Scripture. Isaiah 9 and verse 6 tells us about Christ. The government shall be upon his shoulder, the bearing of responsibility. Then it says, before Hebron. And Rotherham translates it, that faceth Hebron. Peni, the Hebrew. That faceth Hebron. So this could have been a hill somewhere to the east of Gaza, which looked towards Hebron, that faced Hebron. It might be a hill near Hebron. Well, why Hebron, do you think? Why Hebron? Well, Hebron's very important in the scheme of things, isn't it? Hebron means fellowship. And here in the cave of Machpelah, in one of the fields near that town, were buried three faithful married couples. And he's just got out of a bed with a harlot. Alright, think about this. He's just been consorting with a harlot. And he's heading off to Hebron, where are buried three faithful married couples in Israel. There's a lesson to be learned from that, isn't there? And what were they doing there? Buried in the cave of Machpelah, which means folded together. What are these three couples, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob and Leah, doing there? Well, they're waiting. For what for? They're waiting for Christ to come to fulfill the promises made to Abraham. And the last one that God made to Abraham in Genesis 22, verse 17, was that Christ would possess the gate of his enemies. Got a picture? Absolute contrast, isn't it? You've got Samson lolling around with a dollied up woman in Gaza, and there, when he changes his mind and heads towards the east, is lying three married couples faithfully waiting for the day when Christ will take away the gates and possess the gates of his enemy. That is the contrast. Now Gaza is something like 70 kilometres or 40 miles in American terms from Hebron. Now, he may have carried the gates right to Hebron. I mean, any man who can rip them off the posts by divine power is going to have strength to carry them all that way. Not his strength, it's God's strength that allows him to do that. So there's a, you might say at least, a happy ending to that story, but not to the next one. The next one is, of course, the story of Delilah. So here we've got this story ending, perhaps at or near Hebron, and it's at Hebron that he can look down upon the plain of the Philistines and see the issues that confronted him, just like you and I. When you are near the faithful, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and you have their perspective, and you look for what they are looking for, you can actually see the world for what it really is. You can see the issues facing us, young people. That is what he should have learned from this incident in his life. Sadly, he plunges back into the abyss. And that's what we read in verse 4 of Judges 16. And it came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. What a story this is. The valley of Sorek, you know, it was in those days it was a very fertile valley. It was the home of the choicest intoxicants that the world can offer. They made beautiful wine there. They had the purple grape, the very best grape for making wine. And Samson was intoxicated with one of the finest products of the human species as far as Philistines were concerned. A beautiful woman named Delilah. And she lived in an area where this was common sight. There's some grapes growing in the valley of Sorek, and you might remember that when the spies came to the land and they took back the grapes from around Hebron, that they had to have two men carrying on a stake the bunches of grapes. Now, the grapes were not, you know, the individual grapes weren't any bigger than what normal grapes are. It was the profusion of the bunch. You know, normally a bunch of grapes is something like that, football size maybe, but this was so big, the bunch was so big that two men had to carry it back. That was the kind of fertility in this particular region. Perfect Mediterranean climate, perfect for growing the very best grapes. Now Yahweh said in Jeremiah 2:21, "Yet I have planted thee a noble vine," he says to his people Israel, his wife, "holy a right seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto me?" The same question could have been asked of Samson. Why, Samson, why are you fiddling around with a degenerate, strange vine? Well, only he knows. So let's come to the record of verse 4. It came to pass after that he loved a woman. This word loved, Ahab, in the Hebrew, means to have affection. It can have the sexual connotation or otherwise. He loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, a vine, redness. A vine stopped producing, as I said, the very best wine from purple grapes. And her name was Delilah, languishing, to slacken, to be feeble. You know, I see this woman. I see her as one of those sort of, you know, those women that just gets dolled up and they're so confident in their own beauty. They just sort of like they're languid. They're fluid. You ever seen that? They're not nervous. They know where they stand. They have absolute confidence in their beauty. They know they can smite men with their beauty. That's the kind of woman she was. And he's going to fall victim to her. It says in verse 5, that when the lords of the Philistines heard that he was there, they came up unto her and said to her, entice him. See, wherein his great strength lieth, by what means we may prevail against him, and we may bind him to afflict him, and we will give thee every one of us 1,100 pieces of silver. Oh, she was going to be rich. Now they came up to her. That wasn't common practice. Normally, the lords of the Philistines would call their servants to them and say, hey, you come down and see us. No. They came to her, which gives you a clue about how powerful she was. Now, I don't know when someone picked a picture out of Delilah, she could have looked like that. She's one eye anyway, isn't she? That woman. So, here she is. Her name means weak, feeble. But she was clearly a woman of very strong influence. It's been suggested, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility, that she may indeed have been an Israelite. She might have been a Jewess, corrupted by the Philistines, and in league with the Philistines. It's a possibility. Although I think Samson's previous attractions for Philistine women probably rules that one out. But she rates a visit from the five lords of the Philistines. She is going to receive five times, I said 1,000 there, should be 1,100, isn't it? Yes, it's 1,100, I have to correct that. So this is a lot of money. Now, it's very difficult to actually say the exact value in today's terminology, but it's no less than $60,000. It's about the amount that the mafia would put out on a contract, you know, to bump someone off. Yeah, $60,000, probably enough to sort of tip you over the edge, eh? To bump someone off. And that's what they want her to do. They want her to bring Samson to an end. Now, she lived in her own home, without a husband, in the best of the land. Well, there's no reference to a husband. So she must have been a wealthy woman anyway to be in that situation. And moreover, her home was big enough to hide a company of men. See there in verse 9 it said, now there were men lying in wait, abiding with her in the chamber. So in this house, there's enough room for several men, a number of men to hide waiting for Samson and to be overtaken. So clearly, it's a sizable house. She's discerning and mercenary. In fact, she's viciously cruel. When we get to verse 18, we're going to see that. Incredibly cold and merciless in verse 19. And the proverb says, Proverbs 6, verse 26, for by means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. Guess where he ends up? Grinding grain for the Philistines so they can eat bread. By a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread. Terrible, isn't it? Absolutely terrible for one of our kind, one of us young people, Samson. We're going to see him in the kingdom, one of us. This is what's happening to him. Why? Why is it there? Because God doesn't want you to end up like him. That's why it's there. We must learn from the lessons here. So verse 5, they ask, the lords of the Philistine ask, you find out wherein his great strength lies. As I said, it wasn't in his physical stature. He looked like any other man. And that's very important because, you see, the world does not understand spiritual strength, do they? When Samson did his marvellous feats, it was by God's strength. The Spirit came mightily upon him. When you and I confront the world, they look at us, they see, well, we're the same shape, size as other people. But our lives are different, or they should be different. They have no idea why we can resist the temptations that they plunge into. They don't understand why we don't go, as Peter says, to the same excess of riot. They have no comprehension, do they, of spiritual strength. Why? Well, it's not ours. It's from God. It's not our strength. It's what he has put in us. In our case, by the power of his word, generating faith in us. We want to bind him, they say. We want to bind this man. We want to yoke him, hitch him. We want to afflict him. The word means to browbeat. Rotherham says humble. And 1,100 pieces of silver, which, when you go to chapter 17 of Judges in verse 2, we are told represents the life savings of a well-to-do family, the family of Micah, of whom we spoke in our first study. So 5,500 pieces of silver is a lot of money, even in today's terms. And, of course, it was a great inducement for Delilah to cooperate. So she begins. She begins the Eshdaol process. You know, that constant nagging. It starts in verse 6. And Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me, dear, I pray thee." I told you I had a sore throat.
"Please tell me, wherein your strength lieth."
I wouldn't get a job as an actor, would I? I'll keep my day job, as they say. But you got the idea. On and on and on, over and over and over again, day after day after day, until he's sick of it. He ought to have got up and said, "I've had enough." He didn't do that. You know, the desires of his flesh have got a pretty woman there. She might be a nagger, but she's a pretty woman, see? And he can't help himself. He's locked in. So he gets his first prayer warning of the dangers of parleying with the serpent, and he continues to parley. That wouldn't be human nature, would it? Verse 7. And Samson said unto her, "If they bind me with 7 green wisps, or cords, that were never dried, then shall I be weak and be as another man." Now 7 just happens to be the covenant number. And I think the beginning of the process of Samson revealing his true secret. His secret that he has with God begins here. Why didn't he say 6 or 3? Why only 3 cords? Or 9 cords? Why 7? Well, because, you see, that is the covenant number. We're going to see what part that plays. Green wisps, lak, yether in the Hebrew means fresh cords, fresh bowstrings, says the RSV. But they're never dry, that is, they haven't been cut off the vine. So they're green, strong. Then, he says, "I shall be weak." Well, I think he was already weak. He was showing his human weakness, wasn't he? And he says, "I'll be as another man." Another man. 2 Hebrew words. Ikad. Adam. Ikad means one or united. Adam means earthy. I'll be as one who's united with the earthy man. Yeah? That's what was happening. And that's the way he was going. But of course, he's concealed the true secret for the time. And we read that, verse 8, "The Lord of the Philistines brought up to her 7 green wisps which had not been dried, and she bound him with them." Now there were men lying in wait. They were in the house. She said to him, "The Philistines be upon thee, Samson." And he brake the wisps as a thread of tow was broken when it touched the fire, like wax from the fire. So his strength was not known. But here they were, waiting. And of course, it was a false alarm. The wits, the cords, simply melted off him. As like a fire touches a piece of wax. In verse 10, she responds. Delilah said unto Samson, "Behold, thou hast mocked me, and told me lies." I wonder what she was telling him. "Now tell me, I pray thee, wherewith thou mightest be bound." Rotherham says, "Lo, thou hast been laughing at me." And as they say, and it's true, there is no fury like that of a woman scorned. Yeah. And she's going to get her own back, is this lady, if I can use that term, of Delilah. She's going to get her own back. "Told me lies, falsehoods." What hypocrisy. Well, she tries again. Verse 11. "And he said unto her, if they bind me fast with new ropes that never were occupied, then shall I be weak and be as another man." But he takes new rope. Notice what it says here. Well, it was new ropes that the men of Judah had bound him with, wasn't it? In Judges 15, verse 13, he just broke them off. See what's happened? She takes new ropes that were never occupied, where work was never done. Back in verse 8, it was the lords of the Philistines who supplied the cords. Now Delilah goes and finds her own. A scorned woman is seeking revenge. So we read in verse 12 that she bound him therewith. The Philistines came out again. End of the verse, he broke them from off his arms like a thread. And Delilah then starts all over again in verse 13. And so he says, at the end of that verse, he said to her, if thou weavest the seven locks of my head with the web. She was weaving her iniquity, as Isaiah 59 says, as Israel did in the days of the prophet, weaving iniquity like a spider, winding him up. But you know what's happening here, young people? He's getting closer and closer to his secret. Whereas he's bound with cords, arms, etc., now he's directing attention to his head. If thou weavest the seven locks of my head, the seven locks of his head had relationship to his Nazarite vow. Seven, covenant number. So this is pointing to his covenant as a Nazarite with God. He's getting closer and closer, isn't he? Yep, he's in the web. He's wrapped in a loom, you might say. Because it says in verse 14 that she fastened it with the pin and said unto him, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. And he awaked out of his sleep and went away with the pin of the beam and with the web. So this is the language of weaving with one of those ancient weaving machines. In fact, the word fasten has the idea of clattering and making a noise or a clank, so that Rotherham translates, so she beat them up with the pin. She tried to make absolutely certain that he was locked in with the hair of his head, the seven locks thereof. But he went away. Now that's the language that was used in verse 3. Verse 3 says, and he went away from Gaza with the gates. He went away again in verse 14. And, you know, he should have just kept going, shouldn't he? He's given away the first little step that hints at his Nazarite vow. Now, I just want to pause here, young people. Because as I said earlier, I know from experience, and many of you do too, that when you are in this web of deceit that has been woven around Samson, it is extremely difficult to extract yourself from it. Ever seen a fly or a moth get caught in a spider's web? They try very hard to escape, but they're stuck. They're locked in. And it's a bit like that sometimes. You have to make what you might call a superhuman effort to escape. He could still escape, but he's in this spiral that's going down and down and down and down. And you reach a point, and he's going to reach that now. You reach a point where you just don't care anymore. That's where you end up. You don't care about the consequences. Now that is the sad story of verse 15 onwards. And she said unto him, how canst thou say, I love thee? So he's pulled off this beam and he's walked away. Alright? But she says to him, how can you say you love me? So the scorned woman uses the lowest form of hypocrisy to complete this plot of her duped lover. And he can't escape. You know, Proverbs 7, verse 21, which I'm going to put up in a moment on the screen, It's very helpful in relation to Judges 16, and verses 15 and 16, where she says, "You can't say you love me. Your heart is not with me. You have mocked me these three times, but not told me." Notice the occurrence of the term "me." "Wherein thy great strength lie." "And it came to pass when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him so that his soul was vexed unto death." He reaches the point of no return. She urges him until he's happy to die. That's the sad story. So she has got him, young people, mentally. She's got him with her words. Emotionally, she's got him. "How can you say you love me? Where's the evidence of it?" And she's got him physically. She urged him. She's lying all over him. She's using her wiles. The Hebrew means to press upon. So mentally, emotionally, physically, he's locked in. What a terrible situation. That word "pressed" means to compress and thence to oppress or distress. Rotherham says she urged him with her words continually. Urged. Pressed down is the idea. You can just see this pressure, can't you? "Until his soul was vexed," it says at the end of verse 16, "unto death." Vexed? Cut off. Rotherham became impatient, interlinear, grieved. He had reached the point. No return. Unto death. Simply means to put one to death. He didn't care. Eshtael, the voice of the flesh, speaking through Delilah, had prevailed in the life of Samson. So here's the passage from Proverbs 7. Now Brother Thomas uses this in Elpis Israel in relation to Adam and Eve. It reads, "With her much fair speech." This is a woman who's a wife of a man who's away on a journey. Remember that? "With her much fair speech she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, and as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver. As a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is to his life. Hearken unto me now therefore." See, you've got to learn something from this. That's the experience of Samson. You've got to learn something from that. "Hearken unto me now therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways. Go not astray in her paths. For she hath cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men, like Samson, have been slain by her. Her house is the way to the grave, going down to the chambers of death." And that's where this man is now. He doesn't care anymore. So what does he do? Verse 17. "He told her all his heart." It's the last thing you want to do with someone who doesn't share your faith and who's after your life. Tell her all your heart. You know what the proverb says? That the fool pours out his heart before the wicked. He just puts it all out there before the wicked. So he's abandoned his Nazarite vow. It's gone. But he tells her, "There hath not come a razor upon mine head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go from me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." The secret is out there. The commitment abandoned. And he says that he was a Nazarite from his mother's womb, young people. Now those of you in this audience here tonight who happen to be born into Christadelphian families like I was, for which I am hopefully going to be eternally thankful, had a similar situation to Samson. You cannot be given a better gift than to have that as a heritage. It's a type here of all that were born into Christadelphian families. A privilege beyond words. And I'll tell you something. It took me a while to realise that. But there's hardly a day that passes where I don't thank my God for that fact. Because if I hadn't been born into a Christadelphian family, I probably wouldn't be where I am today. And I know that. So there is a lesson for us. You go to bed tonight. Remember that. If you happen to be in that position, to give thanks for the heritage that you were given by the accident of birth. For those of you who have come in from outside, in many ways, that's a similar blessing. A different blessing, but a similar blessing. Because you don't have the handicap of those who are, of us who were born as Christadelphians. You are able to see the truth in black and white, in a way that sometimes those who are born into it can't. You know, that's the problem of human nature, isn't it? When you're given something on a platter, you don't always appreciate it for what it is. There's a very big lesson in that. And he spills it out to this woman who has his demise as her objective. If my head be shaven. Now, a Nazarite would shave his hair on two occasions. One of two occasions. If his vow was broken by contact with death or whatever, then he had to shave off his hair, and the vow would be renewed after a period of time and when certain sacrifices had been made. However, if the Nazarite fulfilled his or her vow, then in the completion of the vow, the hair was shaven and thrown into the fire which consumed the sacrifices that were made. So either failure or success, the hair was shaven. And we're going to see that this man has his hair shaven by the world, and then as it grows again, he realises that the hair is just a symbol. It's not so much what was growing out of his head that's important. It's what's going on in your head that's important, isn't it? And Samson's going to come to that realisation, but he can't see anything. And he says to her, "My strength will go from me." Well, it wasn't his strength. You see the last sentence of verse 20? It says this. And he wist not that Yahweh was departed from him. It wasn't his strength. It was God's strength. So they come down. The Philistines know that their woman has now got this man in her grasp. So the record says in verse 18 that they brought up the money or the silver in their hand. Silver is a symbol for redemption, normally. This man was on the opposite side of that silver coin. And in verse 19, she made him sleep upon her knees, and she called for a man, and caused him to shave off the seven locks of his head. Why did she make him sleep on her knees? That's where you put a baby, isn't it? On your knees? Yeah. She wanted to feel his weakness. And when his hair was shaven off, and he lost the strength that God gave him, she wanted to feel this man's weakness. She was cruel and callous and vengeful. And the record says she began to afflict him, to humble him. And Samson doesn't know what's happened. And it says at the end of verse 19, and his strength went from him. And she says, "The Philistines be upon thee, Samson." And he says, "I will go out as other times before and shake myself." He wist not that Yahweh was departed. Well, yeah, he had many of these experiences, hadn't he? Time after time. But it wasn't going to happen this time. And this phrase, "shake myself," just the one Hebrew word, means the rustling of the mane. It accompanies the lion's roar, the tumble about. And so previously, like a lion, he had gone out. Well, now, of course, the Philistine lion was in control. And the Philistine lion was going to tear him to shreds. And that's what happens. His God was departed from him. You know, James says, doesn't he, in chapter 4, verse 8, that while you are with God, he will be with you. you forsake him, he doesn't have any choice but to forsake you. And that's what happens. The poor old Samson. And it says in verse 21 that the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bored out his eyes. Just like Zedekiah's eyes were bored out. The eye, young people, is a symbol of spiritual intelligence. You know what Christ said about it? He said, the eye is the light of the body. And what he meant by that, of course, is that light enters the eye, it's refracted, messages are sent from the back of the eye to the brain interprets it, and we perceive or understand what we're seeing. That becomes a spiritual thing, isn't it? The divine thoughts from the Word of God are like the rays of the sun. They enter into our ears, or our eyes. Those thoughts create a new way of thinking in our mind, giving us light. See, that's the symbol of the eye. Well, this man's eyes have been mainly used for looking at women. It was his big problem. And so God, in kindness to Samson, takes away his problem. Now he couldn't see anybody, leave alone women. That was the only way that God could recover this man. And they put him in fetters of brass. Brass, of course, is the symbol of the flesh. And he ground grain. Verse 21. They brought him to Gaza, the scene of his little, you know, his affair with the harlot. The place had been strong. They brought him down to Gaza, put him in brass, and he ground in the prison house. Just want to review, in conclusion, this evening, the tragic ironies of Judges 15 and 16. Samson destroyed the Philistines' crops. Now he ends up grinding their grain. Samson slew 1,000 with the jawbone of an ass. Now he's doing the work of an ass as a beast of burden, pushing a mill around. So you can see there. And normally done by an ass or an ox. Samson could not leave Philistine women alone. Now he's performing women's work. It was the woman's job to grind the grain. She collected it, etc. So the poetic outcomes, these terrible ironies that overtake this man, are designed, aren't they? They're designed to bring justice, but they're not designed just for that. God will often bring poetic things into our life. If we're given to one kind of weakness, then something's going to happen to remind us of that. It'll be poetic, usually. And those poetic outcomes are designed to turn men from their folly. And we can be very, very thankful that that's what happened in Samson's life. Without eyes, in this terrible state, he is turned from his folly. And because of that, he's going to be in the kingdom, young people. Don't let anybody say, I'm too far gone. Whatever circumstances overtake you, whatever mess you get into by your own stupidity, don't ever say that you can't come back from it. Because if Samson could, because God worked in his life, then it can happen for you as well. And tomorrow morning, God willing, we're going to have a look at the way in which God's strength was made perfect in weakness.